Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
First, Roshi, thank you so much for attending this session. As you can see by the packed circumstances, many people are happy that you were able to join us today. And along with you, joining the celebration, the birthday of Shoboji, we can join your celebration of Rosh Hashanah, and so Shana Tova for you and all others of the faith. When Roshi asked me to give a talk, I said, how can I say no? But I have to admit, my heart took a leap for a beat or two, and perhaps a sigh escaped my lips. But as you can see, everyone around here is working so hard. Everyone here, whether we're working during meditation, during Zazen, or during the work practice, or the officers, or whatever, we are all here to serve. And of course, I said yes. And not only that, but I think I've sat with most, nearly everybody in this hall. And it's like sitting with the Dharma family. I'm like at a family reunion, giving a small talk. And that is such a wonderful thing. It's a family reunion. It's a birthday party. It's a New Year's celebration. We have a spiffed up Zendo. What more can we ask for? What more need we seek? This is a wonderful place. So to start off, Roshi asked me to give a talk, perhaps of my spiritual path, my spiritual journey. And that I'll do. Some of these stories, I'm sure some of you have heard before, but you probably haven't heard all of them. So let me start with my sob story. Now this is not probably the sob you're thinking about, not S-O-B, but S-A-A-B, sob. This is a Swedish car, at least it was, until it merged with Volvo. But when I was a college student back in the day in Atlanta, I took a trip during the summer to the Mountain West, Elko, Nevada. Wonderful place, many adventures. But that summer will be a story for another time. At the end of the summer, myself and a friend of mine who I met in Salt Lake decided to take a trip to the Grand Teton, Tetons National Park. Now, at this point, the Saab that I had, the Saab was a Saab 96, which I'm sure no one here knows about. It was a grossly underpowered car. It was designed for people in Stockholm to go to IKEA to pick up small objects. That was probably the major use that it was for. It was not good for mountain journeys. It was not good for the Alps. It was not really good for the Rocky Mountains either. But I took that cross country. At that time, I was more impetuous, say. More unpredictable, say. But the car, it could, on a good day, going downhill and a tailwind behind it, could get up to like 60 miles an hour. But even then, on the downhill, the semis were blasting past me. On the uphill, maybe 40 miles an hour. And again, the semis were blasting past me. So it was a car that gave me patience with time. When we made it to the Grand Tetons, it's around 7,000 feet, the park. That car did not like high altitudes. It was wheezing. It was coughing. We were giving it automotive CPR just to keep it going alive in the week or so we were out there. And it was taking a turn for the worst. At one point, about 5 or 6 days into the time there, in an isolated part of the park, the car just gave up the ghost. It just died. And we're trying our best to get it back to breathe again, and it wasn't doing it. The sky was blue, end of the summer, and the Tetons, beautiful place, but that car was just like dead. And at that moment, I just gave up. No hope. At that very moment, a car just like mine, a Saab 96, which were probably just a few thousand of those in the US, drove by me and stopped. And the guy got out and he says, "You're having trouble." And I was like, "Well, yeah, my car is dead." It turned out he was a registered Saab mechanic who was doing climbing tours as a climbing guide in the Tetons. So he roped the car, my car, to the back of his Saab, which is a cousin of mine, drove it to his quarters, which the Tetons had provided for him. And there he had three or four other cars just like mine. It was unbelievable. And he was a mechanic, a registered Saab mechanic. With the few tools that he had, he changed the timing, did some things, mechanical, so simple. And the car came back to life. And then the car made it across moonlit skies back to Atlanta, across the continent. So that was the beginning of my spiritual journey. I was raised Catholic, but I realized there's something more out there. Catholicism is great, but it wasn't speaking to me strongly like I thought a practice should. So this was the beginning, the seminal point that really got me to search more for the practice in my life. A few years later, I went to school in California, L.A. L.A. is it has a spiritual smorgasbord of different spiritual practices, everything from the traditional to the esoteric, everything in between. And when I was there, I did a little dabbling. I went to the buffet once or twice to see what was out there. And just as one of the, because I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do, one thing I started with is to go to this one group in West Hollywood. And they had a healing practice, a healing of the hands, taking the negative energies from individuals and then turning that into light and hopefully curing the individual. Along with that, they had a woman in a wheelchair. And she was a core member of the group. And during the meetings, she would go into a trance. And then she would, after 15, 20 minutes or so, would wake up with a different personality. someone from the past. This is truly West Hollywood speaking here. I remember one in particular was an individual, a man from Atlantis. And he said he didn't like salad because it was rabbit food. And this is many years ago, 40 years ago, but because it was food, I still remember that. So clearly, I thought something was going on. It was interesting. It was vibrant, but it wasn't for me. It didn't have a structure, the underlying foundation that makes the spiritual journey so much more secure, whether it's other major religions, including Buddhism. So then, as time went on in LA, I searched around a little bit more and finally started getting closer to what I wanted. I started sitting with a small group in Venice, California, and I was sitting with, this is back like early, mid-80s, Cretiona Reed, before she transitioned, sitting in California. She had sat with Thich Nhat Hanh, had other training in Vipassana, so that's what we were doing there. We were also sitting with Ruth Dennison at Dhamma Dina in the high desert of California. Beautiful place. Really a wonderful place to practice. It was very severe. The sits were like here, intense, but with a different, under otherworldly quality that DBZ has a different kind of quality. That was more alien in some sense, the Dhamma Dina. Along with that, I do remember that we, because it was cold in the mornings, we would take our blankets and we were doing kinhen, and not in the formal way you were doing it here, but we were doing kind of wandering around, taking our own journey on the property outside, and the kids were going, here they come again! They're kind of getting freaked out by us sitting up there. So it was kind of amazing. Fun place. So that was more in the, it talked to me. And so when Zake, my wife and I, came to New York a couple years later, in the later part of the 80s, 86 I think it was, we were looking for a Buddhist spiritual practice and found Shoboji. As wonderful now as it was then, with changes, but still the practice is like so strong here. I took a Jukai, we took Jukai back in 1990, and Koge Louise there, she had a few years ago, I think, she sent me, we used to have this ZSS newsletter that would come out every once or twice or three times a year or so. And she showed me the one issue that had the Jukai ceremony, had the announcement of who went through the ceremony and their dharma names and such. And I know there's a few people who are more the people who have been around here for a while. So just of my group, which was a group of 20, and I should say before, we did the Jukai, we didn't have like classes. We didn't have things like classes back then, right? No things like classes. We would do, say, work in the library, also known as Muken's bedroom, on the shelves where the books were. We would just spend afternoons sanding that back and forth, get a nice round feel, edge to the shelving. Which is still there. It's quite pretty. There's something about that. Something when if you were part of the Zendo restoration, where we are taking these tiles, these thousands of tiles, and sanding them in the back, the hands-on, the zokening of the floors here in a DBZ, touching that wood, it really brings us closer. It really brings us viscerally into the practice, I think, because you're there hands-on. It was a good teaching tool to sit and not think, just do the work involved, be part of it. So of the students who were in there, there's probably a few that you might remember for those who have been here more than a couple of years, along with Zaki and I, Segan, Ed Glassing, he was the resident here for about 10 years. Seiko, Susan Morningstar, she was more ordained in the Zen tradition. Chimon, Carl Vigiani, he is a sensei authorized to teach Zen by Roshi Robert Kennedy. And I think each year he goes to Beecher House at Daibosatsu Zendo and leads a small group there. Koge, Louise Baer, was in my group, though looking at what Koge sent me, I'm not sure she looked at this closely, but in this very official-looking certificate, it doesn't say Koge, it says Koke, K-O-K-E. I think she got her name wrong. I'm going to tell her about this. We got another Koge around here. I think we're going to call her Koke, because I think that's her true name. But I'll do that later. One final name that I'll mention is Liz Roberts, Kanze. Kanze, a powerful name for Avalokiteshvara. She was about the same age as I. She seemed to have like that connection with the Dharma. So strong. She would just have a presence. Surprisingly, she passed on when she was about 52 or so of a very nasty cancer. I have to say this impacted me relatively strongly. Some of my own age who had the tools of the Dharma at her fingertips, at least from my perspective. And I think we all have a feeling perhaps that the Dharma will save us. And as Roshi alluded to during her opening remarks, the Dharma does not give, Zazen does not give us protection from the vagaries of the world. We may have better health because we have less stress, because we're eating better, but tomorrow is a mystery and no one will be protected. The Dharma does not have it out for you, but neither is it doing you favor. The Dharma will do what it will do. And so I think that taught me this is a precious practice. We do not know if we're going to be here tomorrow. We know others in our Sangha who have experienced great loss, individuals who have died sooner than we had hoped that they would have. We all have experienced loss. So when we sit here, it's not the Dharma is going to protect us, but this practice will invigorate us to be in the moment, to be here now, to help each other and to help the practice. There's a passage from the Dhammapada that I always recall. The simple one goes, the leaves on the tree of life are turning yellow. Have you made provisions for the journey? There's a harsher translation, which might be a little bit better. Like a withered leaf, you are now. Death's messengers await you. You stand on the eve of your departure, yet you have made no provision for your journey. Well, I'm not sure that's completely true. Well, yes, like a withered leaf, we are all now, but provisions for the journey, I guess that's why we're here. We're here in the Zendo making the sandwiches. We're gassing up the car, cooling down the drinks for the journey. However long the journey lasts, we're better prepared for it. My name, as you probably know, is Kokan. Ada Roshi gave me that back in 1990, this Jukai ceremony, which he translated as reflection of wisdom. And over the years, the 30-odd years since I went through the Jukai ceremony, I've asked many people, how do you take these two characters of Kokan? And I get various translations, many of which are not consistent with each other. So, in fact, one time, Suiho, who you might remember, was a resident here before Gion, before Koge, Suiho. And he went to Japan, had this pocket Japanese English translator device. And he was looking for a guide, and somehow he got into his head that he thought guide was Kokan. So he plugged in Kokan in terms of the Japanese section, and what came out? Crotch. The nether region between your legs, crotch. So is this just a practical joke? Play on me? By Ada Roshi all those years ago? No, the characters are different than what's on my roxu. Okay, it's not the same one. I have other ones. But it got me searching, particularly Silkyu, who took the Jukai a few years ago, a couple of years ago, I'm not sure how long, but relatively recently. He mentioned, well, you could search these characters on Google. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a new thing for me. So then this allowed me another avenue to explore my Dharma name. And to be honest, I went through, I wouldn't say it was like days and days, but a number of hours just to explore my name to see if I could go deeper in terms of what it meant. And there's a lot of blind alleys. I found like a nice train station in Japan. I don't think that was it. So those are the kind of things I was coming up with. Until one time, I finally got the hit that I was looking for. So this came from a Google search. It led to a book that's also on Google. And this was Hakuin's Precious Mirror Cave, a Zen miscellany that was edited and translated by Norman Waddell. I think Waddell also translated Hakuin's text in the book Wild Ivy that I think some of you have read previously. In this Hakuin's Precious Mirror Cave, it's mentioned that Hakuin gave the name Kokan, or Old Mirror. The two characters, Old Mirror, is the literal translation of my name, to one of his students, not a monk that he gave it to, but a lay student named Akiyama, a farmer in Japan. He explained the significance of this name as follows. It deals with storehouse consciousness, which if you ever read about this, it's a very complex area that I do not understand this at all. But he explained this in a way that I think made more sense to me. And it goes as follows. This is the explanation of the name by Hakuin to the student. Each and every sentient being is possessed of an old mirror that reflects all things just as they are, without any distortion or lack whatever. All the immense variety of things in the universe, heaven and hell, the pure land, the impure world, the realms of the Buddhas and the demons, birth and death and nirvana, are each of them appearances reflected on this mirror. Being the source of all of these things, this old mirror is called the storehouse consciousness. Since it reflects faithfully all existences without exception, it is called the Great Perfect Mirror Wisdom. If you take a mallet and deliver a decisive blow to the mirror, shattering it so that you see through to its root source, you are then able to use the light of the Great Perfect Mirror Wisdom at will and with total freedom to lead all other living beings to deliverance. So clearly it's more aspirational than but I, you know, Ada Roshi passed a few years ago, and now I look at my Dharma name as a gift from years past. It's something that I can sit with and reflect upon like an old mirror. And it aids me in my practice. So, Kokan. Although, Crotch is a different kind of awesome name that perhaps is good as well. So, you know, all the names are interesting and all are equally awesome. We have to talk about Ada Roshi, who was the abbot here. Ada Roshi was a highly charismatic, profound teacher. He was a wonderful teacher. And he did have positive influence on many of the students here. But also, instead of creating a harmonious sangha, his actions also created or caused a significant fracturing of the zendo, of the sangha, say. At numerous times during his tenured abbot, groups of students would leave. So along with causing significant pain to members of the sangha, and he also caused members of the sangha to leave the path, and that's really tragic. I remember Jinru Roshi, when he gives talks here every 6 weeks, every 2 months, something like that, when he has time. And I remember one talk that he gave, he was talking about fishing almost, fishing for Zen students, or how do you catch a Zen student. And he said the Zen lure is like a, not a hook, but a straight piece of metal. So if the fish catches it, it really wants to be caught, right? Because there's nothing to hook it on. So any actions that cause individuals to leave, to change the harmonious atmosphere, to break the cohesiveness of the sangha, those are things that we really, really have to avoid. The sangha is so precious. We can do such good things. We are doing such good things, and we need to work together to continue that practice. And we all are creatures of light and shadow. None of us are saints. None of us are holy sinners. As you probably recall, the Garden Zen of Chikan Roshi had a ceremony there a few years ago to rename the Garden Zendo into the Ko-in Zendo. The Zendo of light and shadow, a place for atonement and forgiveness. Those who are sitting there are in that special place, so I think anywhere that you're sitting is that special place that you can find some relief from the shadows of our existence. I just recall one time, just this is an important point, in that when I first came here, the Zendo was packed. You know, we would have lines out the door sometimes. And during the time when Eda Roshi left being an abbot, he resigned from abbot, being abbot here, the resident, Sagan, had left. There was really two students here who were keeping the practice alive. So Un and Shoteki come to mind with the support of Shinge Roshi. This is around 12 years ago. This place was at the knife's edge. The patient was breathing weakly. The heart was in palpitations. It was unclear whether the patient would survive or not. But the actions of some students to keep the practice alive, to keep it going. This place might have been converted into one of these, you know, these luxury condos like we see elsewhere on this block, rather than a place of practice. So members of the Sangha who work for the practice and with that, rather than expiration of the practice from Shoboji, a beautiful Zendo, a beautiful place, not only the people within it, but just look around us. It's a gorgeous place to practice, and words fail me. Speaking more personally, I think the light and shadow, I see this in some ways almost as like Greece within me. We have light, but then there are like the darker aspects of our nature. Of course, I have as many as anyone else that can impede the light, the transmission of the light. And I know Daishi, in one of our Thursday evening teas, was mentioning that he sometimes sees, my apologies if I'm misremembering this, but that it's almost that we're sitting with bubbles that are rising up, and which I had a very similar kind of feeling, that we're just within this and the practice is just coming up, and those bubbles are like, they're like scrubbing bubbles, right? They're like the denture cleaner that we have. We put the stuff in there, and then as we sit, that those bubbles are coming up, and some of those the stains, the shadow within us are kind of cleansed away. I think that's a very apt analogy, because I just feeling that it's a true process, or at least one perception of this process that can make us shine more brightly. On this point, the being light, showing your lamp. There's a koan that I'll just mention without discussion. Case 41 of the Hekigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record, entitled Joshu and the Great Death. Joshu asked Tosu, what if a man of the great death, or what if a person of the great death comes back to life again? Tosu said, you should not go by night. Wait for the light of day to come. I'm not going to explain that, but because I was raised Catholic, let me also quote from Scripture, which I think I've probably done three times in my life. Matthew 5, 14 to 16. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Both passages are beautiful in their own tradition. You are the light of the world. You are the light. Where have we heard that before? Like this morning, perhaps? Atadipa. You are the light. Dwell. To paraphrase, you are light itself. You are the refuge. Have no other as your refuge. This is all you need. Light of the Dharma. Refuge of the Dharma. Have no other as your refuge. This is all you need. I think this is one of the beautiful features of being a human. I know we're all perfect, but we are creatures of light and shadow. But even so, our potential is limitless. Although we are creatures of light and darkness, often with a deluded perspective, neither are we always destined to be trapped by our darkness, our delusions, say. So we can be EMTs of the spirit, both working on ourselves and working for others, to save all the innumerable beings, to extinguish our delusions. Hokuto Osho led a class last year on meeting Master Rinzai and knowing yourself. His classes are always interesting. I know that there's another one just that he announced. It was in the most recent newsletter. It's one going to be on poetry. If you've taken his class, it's not a class where you just get back to sit and listen. He wants you to participate. He has homework. He will make you work. But it is because of that work, you find more about yourself, the practice. It's really a wonderful thing to partake of. So if you're interested in poetry, though expect that you will be called upon and have to write a significant amount of poetry, please join it. They're quite interesting. But in terms of this Master Rinzai and knowing yourself, he talked about the Lojong practice, which I was unfamiliar with. Lojong is a practice formulated in Tibet in the 12th century. The use of these slogans, these 59 slogans, that can refine and purify ourselves. And just a couple, they include practical items like work with the biggest messes and obstacles first. You know, for me, this is like, you know, the ones that I always like working the small stuff that you can get done because it's a lot easier. You can finish, you do something, the hard stuff about the messes, oh my God. That's something I'm continuing to work on. Or all spiritual practice agrees on one point, lessen ego, self-absorption. Be unpredictable and forget the slights of others. That's an interesting one. Be unpredictable and forget the slights of others. My personal favorite is slogan 28. Give up all hope of fruition. Give up all hope. You know, we chant the great vows. However innumerable all beings are, I vow to save them all. Is that realistic? It doesn't matter. Give up hope. Just work. Just act. That's what we're here for. In recent days, thanks to the efforts, I think, of, if I hope I get this right, both Kyotai and Enkai, we've had a calligraphy class. We did have an 8-week calligraphy class, mostly taught here by Inez Sun. Really wonderful. I wasn't there at all of these classes, but we're doing characters from the Tao Te Ching. So each week we would have a different chapter that she would read, translate, and then we would take a couple of key characters and work on those. if you've never done calligraphy like that, I have such a greater appreciation now for the scrolls around here. I never really understood them. They look, oh, they're kind of neat, you know. But then trying to do that, even like in a, say, a eight line character, you know, after maybe a 5 hours of work of different classes, just getting one of those lines, wow, that one line. And now this is one line in just a single character, much less the characters we've seen there. Have you seen that great scroll just in the Garden's End? That's my favorite, I think. You look at it, it has life, it has expression, it has such intensity, Nen, that just exudes from it. You can feel the energy of the master in that. And that's the wonderful thing about calligraphy. It's also the darkness of the characters against the whiteness of the background. And each separate is incomplete. You put both together and magic happens, or can happen, in the right hands. But we are, again, I think like the characters, we are all light and shadow, but you know, working at it, we become our own calligraphy of light and shadow, where everything is in harmony. It just feels right. And that's been a wonderful class to partake. And let me just give, just to finish off, I've been talking long enough, so thank you for your attention. One of the different chapters we worked with, I think the one that struck me most strongly was chapter 13 of the Da Vi Ching. It goes as such: accept disgrace willingly. Accept misfortune as the human condition. What do you mean by accept disgrace willingly? Accept being unimportant. Do not be concerned with loss or gain. This is called accepting disgrace willingly. What do you mean by accept misfortune as the human condition? Misfortune comes from having a body. Without a body, how could there be misfortune? Surrender yourself humbly, then you can be trusted to care for all things. Love the world as your own self, then you can truly care for all things. Accept misfortune as the human condition. Recently I went to one of my MDs. I'm getting more now, so I'm getting older. And he said, I'm talking about a pain in my knee, you have classic arthritis. And I was like, wow, that's almost like, you know, like classic Coke, right? Not that new Coke stuff, but you got the good stuff, right? Thank you so much. And I think I would dare any of you to walk 5 minutes in the streets of New York around here, and I bet you would find someone who's hobbling around with some pain, their knees or elsewhere. It's just omnipresent. And I think the thing about the pain, it is a gift. When I pain, you know, how many people in the world have issues, or the knees, or their kidneys, or whatever, suffering. But my pain, I become more empathetic, because now I'm suffering with everybody else. My pain is your pain. Your pain is my pain. Our Dharma hearts beat as one. So just to end the last point, and I am on the board of directors, treasurer, and Daishi was hosting the healing and wellness, And because of various events, I was kind of going back and forth. And I was thinking as I was driving in the near the DBZ property, how beautiful it is. You know, when you see it again and again, it's like, wow, it just gets more beautiful each time I come to visit. Now, ZSS, and not to get too technical, but it's a nonprofit. No one owns this building. No one owns DBZ. ZSS exists because we say it does. Which means that we are all responsible for it. I think I was thinking to myself, I'm a steward, but we are all stewards of the practice. We are all stewards of taking care of each other and where we practice. So I know everyone is busy, but it's so important that whatever you can give, just helping out at Daibasatsu Zendo in whatever way, whatever is within your means. And I'm not talking about money. It could just be coming here and cleaning the floor, things like that. The place exists because the students here keep it alive with the guidance of Gion, the guidance of Shinge Roshi, the guidance of Chigan Roshi. So remember, this practice is for us. This place is for us, and we need to, like the session cautions at the beginning, this changing it slightly. This is a wonderful, a unique practice opportunity, and we must care for it. Please do.
This has been a Zen Study Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.